Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Those of us who live in California are lucky to be surrounded by trees. But how many of us know the names of the trees in our backyards or the trees we pass by and enjoy every day? Well, every tree has a unique story. And today's guest, Jill Jones, tells many of those stories in her new book, Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. Jill Jones outlines our deep connection and affinity with trees. She says the modern American city is a great place to learn about trees. The fundamentally unnatural environment has a far bigger variety than crowded real forests. With 4/5 of Americans living in or near cities, we have long been conscious of our built environment, yet most of us know very little about the other essential part of urban life, our grown environments. On today's Your Call, we are spending the hour talking about trees and their environmental, economic, and health benefits. Jill Jones is a historian and founder of the Baltimore Tree Trust. She was a staff member of the 2010 National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and offshore drilling. Jill is the author of several books. Her most recent is Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. And Jill joins me in studio. Hi, Jill. Thank you for coming in.
Well, it's always great to be in San Francisco.
Well, it's great to have you here, and welcome to a city with so many beautiful trees. I understand you were just at McLaren Park.
Yes, where I saw just massive eucalyptus trees. And I know that they're not natives, and so people now have mixed attitudes about them.
Yeah.
But they do smell wonderful.
Yeah, they do. And as you can imagine, here in the Bay Area, there are very strong opinions about trees. Now, what did you really know about trees before you tackled this project?
Well, I will say I always knew I liked trees, and I could tell the difference between an oak tree and a maple tree. So I knew something about trees. But honestly, I don't think I knew more than the average person, except that I was kind of intuitively aware of them.
And most of us don't know much, right? A lot of us love trees. We love to lay under trees. I love driving to Sequoia National Park or up to Mendocino, and when you drive through that forest of trees, it just feels, I can even feel it right now, so calming. But most of us don't know that much about trees.
No, and the cityscape, you realize, any tree that is there, with the exception of certain parks and woodlands where they can grow themselves, I mean, someone had to put that tree there, make a big selection. So you realize that there's an entire world of people who have devoted themselves to surrounding us with trees. So what motivated me to write this book really was the issue of climate change. Mm. So you think, okay, we're living in cities, they're going to be getting warmer. What can you do about that? And the truth is, there's a very limited number of things you can do, but a major thing you can do is to plant trees, and plant trees that will get big enough to really cool things down. And so that really sort of set me on this journey where I was just a complete enthusiastic innocent.
Well, and you found so many interesting things along the journey. You found out about people who dedicated their lives to making sure that there were trees built in cities. I love the sections about the science behind trees, and we'll talk about that later. But since you brought up climate change, since this is so, so important, talk about what happens when trees pump water vapor into the atmosphere.
Well, they're basically like very large air conditioners. I have to say, I had no idea that trees did this. And I have just this sort of fanciful description in my book that if you could see through the bark of a tree, you would see these millions of tiny thread-sized, threads. And they're basically moving water and nutrients up through the tree all the way up to the leaves. And when they get up into the leaves, which have these little stomatas, they're like little tiny, tiny, tiny mouths, kind of exhale. and really basically an invisible vapor of water comes out of the tree. So it's just not only providing shade, it's really kind of cooling the air around it and moisturizing it.
And talk a little bit about the research on this issue, the scientists who are dealing with climate change, are trees near the top of their list? Because when we do shows about climate change, most of our guests don't really spend that much time talking about trees.
Well, so as we all know, I mean, the very large forests are a huge issue. So the boreal forest up in Canada, I mean, to keep that intact is really important, and it's all being cut up, as these things tend to be. And then, of course, you know, we've been hearing about the Amazon and the Amazon rainforest. I feel as if for 20 years, in attempting to try and preserve that against it being, you know, sort of burned down and turned into ranches. Mm-hmm. And now in Indonesia, they're, each year they burn more of the forest there to create palm oil
right.
plantations. And this is such a scandal because it fills all of Asia. And I suspect California has to be affected by this from time to time because literally the air is just full of smoke and mm-hmm. burning forests. So those forests, I think very much have been viewed for a long time as important to climate change. And it's a struggle to, you know, persuade the countries or for them to have the wherewithal to preserve them. So one of the appeals to me about the urban forest part of it is that because most of us live in urban forests, it just seems so much more doable that we as citizens of cities can take up this issue. I mean, and the goal of writing this book in as entertaining and charming a way as I can do it is to really draw people into the wonderfulness of trees and the fact that any one of us is capable of, you know, connecting up with others, planting trees, and being activists to politicians and to whoever allocates money to just, you know, really make a very lush urban forest. Mm. So that's part of the beauty to me of urban forests is that just ordinary people can get out there and make that happen. And, I mean, honestly, I started the Baltimore Tree Trust because I started working on this book and I looked around Baltimore. And once you start having trees on your mind, you will be distressed at the state of most urban forests. Hmm. You know, that trees don't have big enough spaces to grow in, that there are a lot of empty pits, that wrong trees have been planted places. So the goal of this book, aside from, you know, charming people and entertaining them, is really to provide knowledge so that they can be meaningful advocates for this. And I should say that people are just so intuitively aware of all these trees in the urban forest. But honestly, we all really lack knowledge or thought about this. So it's really about educating people, getting this entire issue on the radar screen, and really trying to mobilize much more political energy and dollars behind something that I think is really simple.
Well, and the story you tell about New York is just, this was one of the most interesting parts of the book because I did not know anything about this. You don't think of New York City as a place to look for inspiration about trees. So many of us who visit love Central Park, and that's where I spend most of my time because I like so much open space. But this is fascinating. So first off, tell us about the scientist Greg McPherson.
So I want to say that really the visionary people in this story of the science are Californians. Hmm. So it really starts with a man named Rowan Rountree, who was with the U.S. Forest Service for many years, but as a scientist working at Berkeley. So they have this sort of interesting hybrid. And back in the late 70s, Rowan Rountree realized that we were in this historic moment. So I just want to back up to put this in a little bit of context. We had an original urban tree movement when Americans began to move into cities in, you know, sort of the 19th century, early 19th century, and then onward. And people were used to living among trees. And trees were also viewed as a form of public health. There was not air conditioning. There was not modern medicine. And trees were viewed as cooling the air and cleaning the air and preventing miasmas and other things that made you sick. So there was very powerful reasons to want to have a significant tree canopy in urban forests. So most of those trees ended up to be American elms, which, if you have any familiarity with them, are these very grand, statuesque, beloved icon of, you know, sort of in the American landscape. And they grow like weeds and they put up with anything. So most cities by, World War II had really wonderful tree canopies. However, they were mainly American elms. Dutch elm disease arrived in the 30s, and over the next decades, really took almost 50 years, essentially eliminated the bulk of the American elms, which meant that suddenly cities in the 60s and 70s, when they were already on hard times because of suburbanization and white flight and what have you, were also losing their trees. And that was really just contributed to this sense of cities as kind of dingy and ugly and full of concrete. However, in the meantime, we also had air conditioning and we had modern medicine. So the issue became, how do you persuade city managers to spend money on trees, which at this point they just view as kind of an ornament that's expensive and troublesome? And so Rowe and Roundtree really understood that you have got to be able to say to a city manager, this tree or this collective urban forest is going to solve a number of problems for you. It's going to improve your air pollution problem. It's going to mitigate your stormwater issues, all which will, you know, affect your sewers and also will affect the quality of the water that, you know, comes out of the sewers. And so the goal became, how do we measure ecosystem services for trees? And then how do we translate that into dollars? And Greg McPherson was one of his two really outstanding graduate students. And he was, the other one is a man named David Nowak. And David Nowak and Greg McPherson are really the two men who have advanced this science over all these years since the 1980s. So the story of New York is, both Nowak and McPherson had really advanced this science to the point that they had achieved what Roundtree was hoping for, which was to be able to go out, take a tree inventory, meaning that someone else had done the tree inventory, and plug that in to this software programs that they had evolved, and be able to tell a city what their trees were worth. And so, if you know, in my book, I describe this in April of 2007. They produced their report, the Municipal Forest Resource Analysis, for all of the five boroughs of New York. And at that time, Mayor Bloomberg was the mayor. And everyone knows that he's a very data-driven businessman. And what he learned was that New York City had 600,000 street trees, and that collectively those were saving $28 million for energy savings, about $47 a tree. Each street tree removed an average of 1.73 pounds of air pollutants each year, which was worth a total of about $5 million. But the big thing was stormwater, and that was about $900 million gallons a year, and that was saving the city almost $36 million. So just if you look at a tree outside your window that's a certain size, that tree in the course of a year is absorbing about 1,400 gallons of stormwater. And depending on where you live, that is a huge expense for the city. So the overall, and then there are all these other benefits that trees have, you know, been quite documented. They really promote economic development. So if you have a shopping area and it's got trees, many more people are going to come there. So you get, you know, more activity. It improves public health. When you're talking about how you just feel yourself feeling better as you get out among the trees, I mean, this has actually been documented. Your cortisol levels come down as you get under those trees. Mm. And that's all about stress, and stress is what causes bad health. So just all those things, the economic activity, reduced human stress, aesthetics, that's worth $90 a tree. So essentially what they were able to show is that for every dollar that you spent for a tree in New York, you were getting back $5 worth of ecosystem benefits. And Bloomberg, who I think all of us would agree is a very business-oriented person, was so impressed by this that he quadrupled the Forest Service budget and he launched Million Trees NYC. So, and which has been accomplished. And all of this was done in a very strategic way. So in at this stage, I mean, New York is really kind of a poster child for how you go about restoring and rebuilding the urban forest.
It's an amazing story because I didn't know that New York City has 600,000 street trees. And then you write that a typical city is doing pretty well if it plants 10,000 trees a year. New York City planted 1 million trees in just 8 years.
Yeah, it was astonishing. So about 200,000 of those ended up being street trees. And that's in many ways the most difficult thing to plant because they're big.
Right.
And you have to water them for several years after that. And in order to do this, they just eliminated the middleman because they were very frustrated. And I should say that Matthew Stevens, who was in charge of the street trees, is now here in San Francisco at the San Francisco Botanical Garden. Hmm. So where he does something different than street trees. In any case, they also were able, through all of this new science, to see that they had sort of a very heavy percentage of London planes, Norway maples, Calorie pears. And therefore, when they eliminated the middlemen and they went straight to the nurseries because they thought, if we need 100,000 trees a year, we have to do this many years out. And we have to make sure we get the selections we want because we want to have more than 100 different kinds of species that we can plant. And so everything about the way they did this was really the ideal.
Wow.
And there's a lot to be learned from that. And many other cities, you know, I mean, this tree science has become very standardized, and any city forester would want now to have a full tree inventory and then use that tree inventory to figure out, well, where are we in terms of, do we have too many maples? How much benefits are we getting from the trees? And the other thing I should say is, you know, all this new technology and mapping abilities, what's come out of that is this realization that when you look at a map of trees, and McPherson is also really responsible for this because he was asked by LA to map where they could plant trees so they could have a strategy, and to do it by Council Manic District. And that was back in 2006, so 10 years ago. And everyone was sort of stunned. Again, what you know intuitively, they now learn through data, which is you live in Bel Air, you've got a 47% tree canopy, which is means what a bird sees from above. Hmm. A bird looking on Bel Air, half of what they see will be trees. A bird looking at South Central, 6% of what they see will be trees. So it really shifted the way L.A. plants trees. And that's actually been taken up in a lot of places. I have to say in Baltimore, same thing for us, my tree group. We plant where they're the lowest tree canopy. So it's, you know, very intentional because if you know that trees are really essential to the well-being of humans, then it's a very obvious situation of environmental justice to be planting trees where there's low tree canopy.
Jill Jones is my guest today, and she is the author of the new book, Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. She's a historian and founder of the Baltimore Tree Trust. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls, but I hope you can visit yourcallradio.org and check out Jill's work. Can you talk more about environmental justice? Because, wow, 6% versus, what was
40, Bella? 47%.
That is just huge. Are we seeing changes? I mean, you know, I think about the election, and this is definitely not getting much attention, but at local levels across the country, are politicians talking about these issues? Are they aware of the benefits of trees? Is this important to them?
It seems to come in waves. So when New York did the Million Trees project, a number of other cities committed also. I should say shortly thereafter, the economy, so this in 2008, of course, the economy collapsed. New York pressed on, and they did it. In fact, they did it early. That wasn't so true in other places. It's very hard to plant a million trees. It sounds great. And so a lot of places committed to that and then kind of backpedaled. But I do think there is a rising awareness, but it seems like there's more commitment to, like, planting trees than to caring for trees. And so I do want to be certain to mention here that in San Francisco, one of the things I learned when I made arrangements to come here is that your local, very wonderful tree advocacy group, Friends of the Urban Forest, is pushing hard for Proposition E. Mm-hmm. So on November 8th, when I guess everyone has to wade through many, 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 many propositions, Proposition E is one you should pay attention to. It's a very sort of an odd story, it seemed to me, which is that apparently the city of San Francisco decided it would transfer responsibility for the care and maintenance of street trees, which if you look at the size of some of these, or even the idea that, like, just random residents would somehow know how to take care of the tree in front of their house, they transferred the responsibility to 21,000 homeowners. And so this understandably distressed a lot of people and has now made this an issue. And I guess they stopped at that. And so the idea of Prop E is to actually require the city to be responsible again for all of its street trees, because it seems very unfair, even if they made every property owner responsible. But I mean, right now, there's just 21,000 property owners who are responsible.
Right.
So
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of the measures we have not discussed yet on our election series. We've got 42 at the state and local level. And I'm just looking this up, Prop E from San Francisco Public Press. And it's a charter amendment that would make it City Hall's responsibility once again to maintain trees and surrounding sidewalks, the care obligation of which had recently transferred to private property owners, and the Board of Supervisors voted 11-0 to put this initiative on the ballot.
Ah, so they see the error of their ways.
They probably heard from their constituents.
Right. So, you know, but in the meantime, I would also say, since people are, you know, this is an issue that's come to people's attention, it is a good time just to realize, oh, well, I don't personally have the wherewithal to be responsible for my street tree, but I would really, you know, urge everyone to look at the Friends of the Urban Forest and support them, whether, you know, coming out as volunteers or financially, because that is the big issue. While on one hand, having a good urban forest in the scheme of overall costs for public issues is pretty small, it is always the thing that gets cut, or that, you know, money isn't allocated to it, simply because, again, it's not on people's minds. So one of the good things about this is it's like sort of forcing people to be aware of it.
We're going to take a quick break, and then after we come back, maybe we can talk a little bit about street trees and what's the best way to interact with the trees that are right outside of your front door. Today I'm joined by Jill Jones, author of the new book, Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the ongoing protests at Standing Rock. Thousands of Native Americans and their allies have been resisting the construction of the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline. Since August, over 400 people have been arrested. Last week, police in riot gear deployed armored vehicles, beanbag rounds, and an audio cannon to push protesters away from the private land owned by the pipeline developers. Join us live at 10 a.m. with Rose Aguilar and you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, I'm joined by Jill Jones. She's author of the new book, Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. Jill writes that as we wrestle with how to repair the damage we have wrought on nature and how to slow climate change, urban forests can and should serve as one part of a very obvious low-tech solution. Jill is a historian and founder of the Baltimore Tree Trust, and you can find more information about her work at yourcallradio.org. Before the break, we were talking about Proposition E in San Francisco that would make it City Hall's responsibility once again to maintain the trees and surrounding sidewalks, which was transferred recently to private property owners. Again, this is Proposition E. What would you say about our relationship with our street trees? I'm thinking about the trees on my sidewalk. I see them. I look at them every day. I don't really do much with them, but I do. I am curious. Sometimes people come and cut them, and I wonder who made that decision.
Well, and I hope they do a good job because there's a lot of tree butchering as opposed to tree pruning. Hmm. And that's where the money part of things comes in. It's really important to have a well-trained forestry division where you actually have employees who are there from, you know, this is their career. So, unfortunately, a very typical model is that you low bid these things out. They go to companies that do not have trained arborists doing this, and they just kind of willy-nilly hack away at the trees. And a tree is a long-term investment, and the pruning of it is incredibly important. So if a tree is improperly pruned, it is then open to disease. So the first thing I would say is that the goal of any city and the goal of any tree group in a city, like a grassroots group, is really to be as supportive of the funding of the forestry division as anything. Because the reality is, to take good care of trees, you need to get up in bucket trucks. You need sometimes to be able to actually climb in the trees. And you really need trained arborists who know what they're doing. Hmm. So that is very important. The other really important thing is to have ordinances that protect trees. So, for instance, in Washington, where a lot of trees are on private property, you cannot take down a tree that is bigger than, you know, the diameter of the trunk is more than like 12 inches without having an arborist come and pass judgment. Now, obviously, if the tree is diseased and old and the danger, I mean, down it comes and that's it. But if you just want to take that tree down because you feel like it, for whatever your reasons are, you are now going to pay a fairly significant sum of money, not only to the city, but, I mean, you would pay a significant sum of money to the arborist to take down a big tree anyway. But you're also going to pay that money to the city because the city recognizes that the collective urban forest is delivering all of these benefits. And when you, it would be like if you decided, oh, you know, I don't really want this part of my sidewalk here, even though that sidewalk is necessary for people. It's not exactly a one-on-one analogy, mm-hmm. but, you know, it's sort of that idea.
Right.
Like, oh, I'm just going to leave my car running and, you know, fill the air with pollution because I feel like it. So that's really important. I mean, we do not have that in Baltimore. And you just, people will come to you and they are just so distressed because the neighbor next door has bought the house and the land. And they, you know, raved about the trees. And as soon as they get possession, in come, you know, the chainsaws. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing to be done. And it's true that even with these ordinances, if people wanted to pay that kind of money, but you really think twice if you're going to have to pay $2,000 for the right to take down a tree in addition to the cost of taking down the tree.
Well, and then you think about wild places. The Bay Area is just growing so fast, we cannot keep up. And so there's so much development happening. Mm. And one of my colleagues is lucky enough to live in a house with beautiful wild space behind her. Not anymore. She woke up one day, she found out that the land had been sold. And the bulldozers came in, and she showed me the before and after pictures. Oh. I mean, she was crying when she showed me these photos. She had squirrels and deer and birds and beautiful trees. All of a sudden, gone.
Yeah.
The squirrels, the deer, they're coming and thinking, what happened to my house? What happened here? And she said she had no say. She ran out there, and she put yellow tape around the trees that were closest to her backyard and begged people, please do not cut down these trees. I think they saved one of them.
Yeah, well, that is certainly another thing. If you happen to live next to what we call a forest patch, I mean, again, from mapping in Baltimore, we discovered that a lot of the canopy is forest patches, and very typically they are privately owned. So, again, you know, the most important thing is knowledge. You need to educate yourself about, now, even if she'd known this, could she perhaps have afforded this, maybe not, but she might well have persuaded other people to come together in her community and preserve that as open space. But, you know, unless you think about these things and realize these trees are incredibly important, and I actually had someone else raise a very similar kind of issue. You know, we have this forest patch. We have these really big old trees. It looks as if they're going to get cut down. I mean, what can we do? Well, I mean, what you can do is, as best you can at that sort of late date, try and mobilize to stop it.
Right. And population explosion is a factor here because we just don't have enough housing for people. And so, therefore, developers buy this space. They get rid of the trees. And she even said, you know, if it were affordable housing, maybe I wouldn't feel so bad. But they're putting up McMansions.
Yeah.
Right? And then with consumption and people's diet habits in different parts of the world, we're seeing clear cutting for cattle. And it just goes on and on. So that's also part of this.
It is. And again, you know, so as you hear that sort of stuff, it's like, well, what can we do? And again, to me, that's sort of the beauty of just paying attention to your own urban forest and making it as wonderful as possible. And I should say, you're wondering, what can I do for my own trees? I don't know that this is necessary in San Francisco. I really do not present myself as a tree expert. I'm not an arborist. But I am guessing that trees here, like all trees, love water. So, you know, I think you cannot water your trees too much. But also mulch. So in the forest, you know, the leaves come down and they biodegrade, and that, it, you know, feeds and makes rich the soil around the trees. So, you know, an ideal thing is actually to put down some kind of mulch, and that's something of a replication of what goes on in the forest. So,
today I'm speaking with Jill Jones about her new book, Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. Jill celebrates trees and the role they play in our cityscapes. And she says with more people choosing to live in cities and with climate change upon us, the time has come for politicians and city leaders to get serious about creating the lushest tree canopies we can nurture. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take your phone calls, but you can find out more about Jill's work at yourcallradio.org. I want to talk with you about some bad news here in California for a minute. We are facing major climate change, major, major droughts. We're now in our fifth year of our drought in California. When you were talking about trees wanting to be watered, I was feeling bad for all the trees because, well, now we're in October. I'm hoping we're going to have rain this winter. But in the past 10 years, we've lost 60 million trees to drought, fire, and disease. And according to scientists at UC Davis, in Northern California, an invasive pathogen called sudden oak death is infecting hundreds of different plants, from redwoods and ferns to backyard oaks and bay laurels. The disease is distantly related to the cause of the 19th century Irish potato famine and appears to have arrived recently. So what are we really faced with when we look at what we're losing right now?
Yeah, well, so, you know, a certain amount of my book is devoted to the story of the Asian longhorn beetle, which is, so that you're just talking about how you didn't know about all this, you know, tree stuff in New York. Well, most New Yorkers do not know that for 20 years, the federal government has been battling the Asian longhorn beetle in New York City. I think they are likely to probably prevail. But the emerald ash borer, which has not crossed the Rockies, so you don't have that yet, is in 28 states, and the expectation is that will largely wipe out the Native American ash. Again, these things play out over decades, but it's pretty relentless. So we live in a very global world, and I was actually very relieved just as I was finishing my book, which was actually a lot more recently than one would expect under these circumstances. I was slotting things in at the last minute. I learned about this new legislative initiative, which I try and let people know whenever I speak. It's called Tree Smart Trade. And like everything else, it has a website. And it's an initiative that's been put together by scientists and policymakers, and they're actually working on Capitol Hill to try and get this passed. And the essence of it would be to end all use of wooden pallets, because that is very typically how these creatures get in. Mm-hmm. And we have tens of millions of containers coming in, and they've got wooden pallets in them.
Okay.
The second part would end all further importation of live nursery stock.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I of course there's a wooden pallet lobby, and of course there's a nursery lobby and so forth. But I do think as more and more of these terrible things make their way to our shores, you know, sort of hitching a ride in this way, it's really hard to argue that any of these things are more valuable than what they're now destroying. And IKEA does not use wooden pallets. They're a big global player, so they use paper. So I think they're an example of how this can work. And we, the taxpayers or the homeowners, pay the cost now of these losses, and they are significant. So I would imagine, I hear all, I mean, it is really heartbreaking to hear that yet more things have arrived, and they are just erasing not only trees but all other plants. In the case of the emerald ash borer and also Dutch elm disease, which is still with us, there, if you have a beloved tree, you can save that tree. You can inject that tree with pesticide, and it will address the beetles that carry the fungus. So, and I've actually seen this in my neighborhood. We have a number of really beautiful, mature American elms, and as a neighborhood, we pooled together and we got them injected, and They were looking very bad, and now they look really great. But you know, what can you do? I mean, tree smart trade, that's something. It's very hard to know when the plants are so stressed. If they weren't stressed after 5 years of drought, these things may not have been bothering them at all.
Hmm.
But
it's so interesting. I've never heard anyone talk about that part of globalization. We're so used to now to getting most of our stuff from overseas. When you think about live plants and things that we buy in our nurseries, never even thought about this.
Well, I don't think that's the bulk of them, but it's certainly enough
right.
that, yeah, things come in on them.
Huh.
And in fact, actually, the chestnut blight, which came in was, you know, identified in 1904, and is really a southeast issue because the American chestnut does not grow elsewhere. But that was a blight, and it was windborne, and that just wiped out the chestnuts in the southeast. They were gone, and the chestnut blight is with us to this day. And they realized later that came in on nursery stock in Long Island. And, you know, it takes a while for these things to sort of acquire enough force to kind of be unleashed on the land. But that was nursery stock, and they knew that then.
Wow. And you write that so it wiped out the American chestnut by the 1930s. This killed 200-year-old chestnut trees.
Yeah, in a matter of like a year or two.
Wow. And to this day, you cannot grow a mature chestnut tree.
Nope.
Why not?
Because the blight is still around. It's very, it resides, I guess, in the soil, and it's windborne and, you know, squirrels, birds, what have you. And the America Chestnut Foundation feels that they are on the right track. They're very dedicated. I had a delightful day in Brooklyn going around with a man named Bart Chazar, who's been planting chestnuts there, and he has actually harvested a few actual chestnuts, but his trees have gotten blight, and this is a very unusual situation. Some scientists have actually come up with transgenic American chestnuts, in which they have inserted a wheat gene that neutralizes the acid that's produced by the blight and that kills the tree. So, but you know, this is sort of very scary stuff, and you know, people have very mixed feelings about this, and none of these trees would ever be allowed to bloom now, because what would that mean? So, but they do exist, and they are growing, and you know, that's one approach.
Today I'm speaking with Jill Jones about her new book, Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. And her book is full of so much really interesting information about trees, the history of trees, the diseases, foreign invaders, how they dealt with foreign invaders. And then she also takes a look at how trees will help us deal with climate change. This is a major, major solution that deserves far more attention. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take your phone calls. I want to make sure we also talk about our emotional health, because you have some really interesting information in your book about how community mapping of tree canopies correlate with better birth outcomes for pregnant women, and then also low stress levels among all of us, which frankly, we can all use in this very go, go, go connected world that we live in now. So first off, tell us a little bit about what scientists are doing to learn about trees and how it helps our health.
So scientists have been at this a long time, and the original study that was done came out in 1984 by actually a landscape architect named Roger Ulrich, and it caused... I hadn't realized this until I went back to research. It caused a worldwide sensation and was in, I believe, Science. So he was in this unusual situation where a hospital had gallbladder patients who were recovering from surgery, and everything about them was comparable. But one group could see trees, and the other group saw a brick wall. And so they followed these patients, and what they found is that the patients with the tree needed less medication, and got out of the hospital a day earlier, which economically is huge, and their progress was better. So he published this in 1984, and it just was – people were – it was worldwide news, and it actually apparently has changed the way hospitals are designed.
Wow.
So that was kind of the beginning, and then it's been going on since then. But our ability to look at these things is so much improved by giant data sets and technology. So a very recent one, which I really quite loved, was done in Toronto because they have a National Health Service and they have a fully mapped trees, and done by a man named Mark Berman, who's at the University of Chicago, because people were wondering, well, what is the benefit of, like, a city street tree? And so he did this by looking at these big data sets and putting them together. And his result was that if you had 10 more street trees on your street, your own health perception would be that you either were making $10,000 more a year or you were 7 years younger. So, you know, that really sort of shows you how much better trees can make you feel. I mean, they're really good for your psyche. More seriously, Jeffrey Donovan, who's a scientist who works out of Portland, Oregon, was looking at pregnancy. And this, I should say, is science that's been replicated or also done in a number of foreign countries as well as apparently somewhere in California. That you looked at the pregnant women, where they were living, you looked at the location of trees nearby, and then you looked at the birth outcome. And the women who had, you know, more trees and it's controlled for, you know, all the other things, had heavier birth weight babies. And that has implications for the entire trajectory of the child's life. Mm. So then Donovan flipped that. There's huge losses from emerald ash borer, and this has been well documented. And he looked at, again, big data sets of mortality in 15 states and where they had lost 100 million ash trees. And in that case, what he saw is that you were having earlier deaths. So contrary to what you would expect under normal circumstances, 5,000 people died sooner than you would think from respiratory disease. And I think the figure was maybe 12,000 from cardiac diseases. And not surprisingly, these effects were strongest in affluent counties because that's where you have the most trees and therefore where you lost the most trees.
Right.
So Donovan has this line that I truly relate to, or, you know, it resonates with me, which is trees are literally a matter of life and death.
Mm.
So I really have come away from all this time I've spent working on this book, believing that trees are really just essential to us as human beings. Evolutionarily, we began our lives in trees, and we have an emotional bond with them that we can't really explain, but it exists. And, I mean, one of the things that was very fun about working on this book was getting to know all these rather eccentric, charming and incredibly knowledgeable, but in ways that were new to me, scientists and activists that really are responsible for either us having the trees that we have or for generating the knowledge about the trees that surround us.
And I'm sure they appreciated you taking an interest in their work and then writing a book to give such a big voice to trees.
Yes, this has actually been a huge relief because this was unlike any book I had written. And I was a journalist for many years and worked as a journalist. And then I got a PhD in American history, and I really spent, you know, quite a few years writing narrative nonfiction, Gilded Age, epics of, you know, sort of Edison versus Tesla, Westinghouse, the story of the Pennsylvania Railroad coming into New York City, the story of the Eiffel Tower and the Paris World's Fair of 1889. So I was very much, you know, working in archives and history. And I started working on this book, and, you know, the first part of it is about the early history and all these wonderful personalities and, you know, the plant explorers who go to China and Frank Meyer Lemons. Mm-hmm. But then it was like, oh, my God, I'm back being a journalist, which I had not done in a long time. So I fretted a lot about, you know, how to organize this book and write this book. And I have to say I've been really gratified because many of the people who are in this book and people who know a lot about trees are just telling me they have learned so much themselves. Mm. And, you know, that they really love the book. And so it's just so gratifying to me because I just was so felt so uncertain in a way that was not true with my previous books of how to tell this story.
Hmm. And how has this book and this experience changed the way you think about climate change and the environment at a time when we're not even getting substantive questions about this in the presidential election, and yet we're in a crisis, really?
Yeah. I guess I feel as if most things that you read about climate change just make you, you know, feel very discouraged. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like, okay, here is a bright spot, something that's doable, mm-hmm. and that we can all enjoy.
Right.
You know, I mean, I don't feel that I personally can do that much about you know, what happens with the boreal forest. I mean, yes, you can give money to organizations that do something about that. I guess it's the doableness of this and the fact that we have all these, you know, all this new technology and mapping abilities make this so strategically possible in a way that wasn't true 10 years ago. So for anyone who's interested in all this data stuff, if you go, there is a website, it's a public domain software program called iTree, and you can see all the ways that you can make use of this data and the mapping and so forth. So I just feel like this is this rare circumstance in the world of climate change where we regular citizens can sort of jump in and make things different.
Jill Jones is the author of Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. You can find more information about Jill and her book at yourcallradio.org. Jill, thank you for giving a voice to the trees, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. And I would say it's great fun in San Francisco because the trees are very different than what we have on the East Coast. And, you know, it's just fun. I've been taking a lot of photos.
Well, enjoy yourself. It is beautiful. I hope you can go to Sequoia and see the largest tree in the world.
Well, I did go to Trinidad a number of years ago, and I saw some very, very big trees there. But I don't think I've seen the biggest. So, yeah, that's in my future.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
Okay.
On the Next Year Call, we'll have a conversation about the ongoing protests at Standing Rock. Thousands of Native Americans and their allies have been resisting the construction of the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline. Since August, over 400 people have been arrested. Last week, police and riot gear deployed armored vehicles, beanbag rounds, and an audio cannon to push protesters away from the private land owned by the pipeline developers. Join us live at 10 a.m. with Rose Aguilar and you.